Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and boy, Craig, you may be an environmental reporter and a New York Times bestseller, but not even you are the Tarzan of Florida. But today, we're talking about the Tarzan of Florida, one of these colorful characters I had no idea about, Trapper Nelson.
Trapper Nelson is one of those legends of Florida that a lot of new people moving here don't know about. They're colorful figures from our past, like the Barefoot Mailman. We did a show on that too long ago that people really ought to know about. I mean, people come to Florida and they think history starts, you know, with Disney World.
And
a lot of stuff happened here before Uncle Walt got here.
Sure. And he's almost kind of, a Davy Crockett figure or, you know, a frontiersman, something like that, got to Florida in the Depression era. And this kind of continues a theme we've had in 2022 focused on the Martin County area, where we did an episode on the Houses of Refuge and the Ashley Gang. And this is all sort of that same period right around as the railroads coming in. This South Florida is still frontier, but it's a frontier that's developing, that early mid-20th century South Florida area that, you know, would become so iconic and representative of the state, that still at this time really is in a lot of respects a wilderness.
Yeah. I think it's great that we can look back to those times and look back to what Florida was like during those times, both the good and the bad, which we'll get into when we talk to our guests.
It goes to show just how rich that Florida history is. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. You book all the guests on the show, and so many surprises. You know, I mean, we do a lot of topics that people are, generally familiar with, but then there'll be ones like this that come totally out of the blue, and you would just think that for all of the attention that Florida has gotten for so long, that you would have heard of these kind of things. But I mean, literally, Trapper Nelson, the name was completely unaware to me until receiving the email from you that, hey, this is the person we're talking to, and you were going to be having this subject. Like, what on earth is this? And it is still one of those kind of cognitive dissonance things when I think about Martin County and Jupiter and Tequesta, that well less than 100 years ago, you know, that's jungle, essentially. And amazing.
Well, to me, I think it's worth reminding everybody, especially the new folks who are moving here to Florida, that there are some giants who walked the land in those days. We talked about Stetson Kennedy folks like that. Just, you know, they're worth remembering. It's worth knowing their stories. Well,
just last week, the Everglades episode, again, that's one of those. Everyone's obviously heard of the Everglades, but, you know, there's so much,
Have they heard of Ernest Coe, who's sort of the father
Jennings,
of the Everglades? Yeah,
you know, some of these, exactly. These other figures who exist below that Henry Flagler level that deserve a great deal of attention, and Trapper Nelson, our subject today, is one of them. Well, this part of the world is not far from where Windstorm Products took shape in the 1980s, I believe, and it was slow and steady, and then the online revolution happened, and Windstorm Products became windstormproducts.com, and it became the world's largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. And hurricane hardware is all that stuff, the bolts, the screws, the nuts, the wing nuts, the fasteners, the drill bits, everything you need to secure all, you know, your shutters and your doors and your patio furniture. And whether you own a home or a business, or you've got an outbuilding, some kind of garage or a workspace, a she shed, whatever it happens to be, you know, the next time that hurricane blows through, you want all your property secured from the wind damage. And that's what hurricane hardware is. And that's what Windstorm Products is here to help you with. Windstormproducts.com. They have everything that you need to secure your home from hurricane wind damage, and they also have support. There's an 800 number in the upper right-hand corner of the website. You can give them a call and say, hey, here's my situation. Here's what I've got. Here's what I'm able to do. Here's what I can't. Help me out. They can even get you in touch with contractors all across the state to do the work that you can't because they've been in business for so long and they know all these folks. Windstormproducts.com. Our guest this week is James Snyder, and he lives in the Loxahatchee River down in Martin County in this area that we're talking about. He has written a book, Life and Death on the Loxahatchee, the story of Trapper Nelson. How'd you get connected to Jim, Craig?
Well, I was actually up in Jacksonville and stopped by the book emporium there, the well-known used book emporium, and picked up a copy of his book. I have been wanting to learn more about Trapper Nelson, and there was a book about it. So I picked it up and then said, this is fascinating, and contacted him and said, would you please be a guest on our podcast? So.
Fantastic. Well, Jim's been a Florida resident since the early 90s and found himself equally fascinated by this legend of Trapper Nelson, which he will share with us on this episode.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about this very fascinating figure from Florida's past. Why should people know about Trapper Nelson? What did he do that was so remarkable that people ought to remember his name?
I think on two levels, perhaps. One is that he was a very unique person himself. I mean, in his heyday, he was 6'2", 220. He could have been an NFL linebacker, and he decided to go upriver, far from known civilization at the time, and literally live like Tarzan did. On another level, he sort of represents one man battling against the onrush of development in all its many forms of. At the end of his life, he had something like 1,100 acres, and he was resisting development and poaching and all sorts of things, which I can get to if you want to talk about his life sequentially, but whatever you like.
Let me first start by one of the things you learn pretty quickly in this book is his name was not Trapper Nelson. His name wasn't even Nelson.
That's right. He was born Vincent Notuglewitz in Trenton, New Jersey in 1908. And his parents had come from Poland, and his father really didn't speak English even. So as a young kid, he used to go shopping with his father and haggle with the various merchants to get the best deals he could. And he was apparently a very smart lad. His Trapper Nelson's mother died, I'm not sure when, maybe when he was about 12. And he and his brother, Charlie, who was 8 years older, really didn't get along with the new mother, I guess. And one thing led to another. And pretty soon they were out trapping in the woods most of the time. The state would pay him $5 a piece to trap muskrats up in New Jersey. And that led to riding the rails as a hobo in the Depression era, in the beginning of it. And so they went all the way out to Arizona and California, in Mexico in one case. And they're trapping the whole way, and that was to be their life.
And they took a third person with them, right?
They took a young buddy of Trapper's named, I should say Vince at this point. He wasn't known as Trapper Nelson then.
Yeah.
But his name was John Dykus. And I think there was a triangle going from the very beginning where Charlie, being 8 years older, felt himself Vince's protector, and he was also a bit bossy. I think he was also a drinker, and I think the two younger guys bonded more, and increasingly, Charlie felt himself on the outs with them. This was after they had gone to Jupiter when they were riding the rails. I'm not sure exactly how much the conflict there was at that point.
Well, they were headed for Miami, but they stopped there in Jupiter. What was it that caught their eye?
Well, they were riding in a boxcar early one morning, and I think Trapper pushed open the door big enough to see the sunrise, and he looked down, and they could see fish kind of stacked up like cordwood beneath them, and out in they could see the open Jupiter Inlet at that time, and I think they just decided on the spot that this was good enough for them. They had both fish and game, and they wound up on the beach in Jupiter, which they couldn't do today, of course, but they wound up trapping for a living for a couple years, and eventually got enough money by sending their skins, their pelts up to New York to sell to wholesalers. They eventually got a jalopy and were able to make a go of it, I guess. And it's at that point where the triangle took place, where I think Vince had told his buddy John Dykus never to quarrel with Charlie, just let it blow over. And Vince had told his brother one evening that he thought he ought to go. And Charlie thought about it. He said, all right, but I want a third of all the money you got. Dykus had been the treasurer for the little group. The next morning, Dykus was cooking breakfast. Vince was out inspecting his traps on the beach. And Charlie came out, and he said he wanted his money right then, his share of the savings that they had. And Dykus really didn't say anything, because I think he was told never to argue with Charlie. So he was stirring the breakfast, and Charlie said if he didn't pony up with the money in 15 minutes, he'd kill him. And 15 minutes went by, and Dykus was still stirring the eggs and bacon. Charlie emerged from their lean-to with a shotgun. I think it had only one working barrel in it. He put it to Dykus's head and let it fly. And he killed him right on the spot and blew his brains out.
And Vince wound up testifying against his brother, didn't he?
Yes, he did. The trial was front page news all the way from West Palm Beach and even into the Trenton, New Jersey newspapers. And so there's a very good daily account of what went on at the trial. There really weren't any witnesses to this whole thing, except that Vince Nelson testifies that contrary to Charlie's testimony that Dykus was shipless and not much of a trapper, he said, no, he was a good trapper. He was very conscientious. And that testimony, really being the only one that there was before the judge, weighed heavily against Charlie. And the judge sentenced him to life imprisonment at in Rayford Prison, which is up near the Georgia border. And there he went. And Vince himself, I think, was totally broke. He had to pay $500 for bail money. So he wound up going back to Trenton and working at a dairy farm, 1,500-acre dairy farm. And meanwhile, he would write some friends back in Jupiter that his ambition was to come back to Jupiter, which in 1934 he did, again in the midst of the Depression. Then he got himself a big rowboat. He had traps at that point, and he put all his gear in that rowboat, and he rowed 9 miles up river. And there he found the foundation of an old, apparently some other trapper's campsite at one point. And he decided that's where he was going to stay the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. And as I said at the outset here, by this time he was 6'2", 220 pounds. And he looked a lot better, really, than the Tarzan of the movies. And up in Stuart, Florida, 20 miles to the north, which is the only town of any consequence, the Lyric Theater was playing Tarzan movies every week. And when Vince would come and row into town for his provisions every week or so, he'd be walking down the street of this little town, which was no more than 200 people at that time. And people would say, I wonder what he's doing up there, you know, and it's the middle of the Depression. They didn't have much money to do anything anyway, except some had gas for their motorboats. And they started coming up to trappers to visit him. And they soon learned to bring not just two sandwiches, but maybe three, because Trapper had a legendary appetite. So that's the way it unfolded. Pretty soon, I think probably in 2 or 3 years later, a sign went up, Trapper's Zoo and Jungle Garden. Well, by this time, he had constructed a 100-foot-long dock, a covered dock. He had orchards going with all sorts of tropical fruits. He had a big water tower to water his orchards, and he had pineapple plants. And the big attraction was were pens full of animals that he trapped. Alligators, of course, possums, like an albino possum. The big attraction to kids was a barrel full of rattlesnakes. And he would pay the local kids $1 a foot for rattlesnakes. So that apparently that was quite a deal. And he would charge 25 cents for kids and 50 cents for adults. And more and more people started coming up there. Tour boats from as far away as Palm Beach, the Breakers Hotel, would come up. It was like a 30-mile trip to come up to see trappers. And it had pretty much of a set pattern to it. They would come up, they'd probably arrive just about at noontime. And a lot of rich people staying at the Breakers, they would have a packed lunch by their tour guide, and Trapper would be on the dock, and he'd usually have a indigo snake wrapped around him. And for a lot of years, he wore an actual leopard skin Tarzan costume. Looks a little hokey now, but in the photos, it's pretty effective. Mm. So he would give us a little lecture about living out there, which was at the time totally in the wilderness. I mean, today we have Florida Turnpike running not more than a mile from Trapper's Place, north and south. And we have I-95, which is sort of joined to it, running this in the same direction. We also have places like Jupiter Farms, maybe only a mile and a half away from Trapper's. That's a well-established rural community of acre homes and that sort of thing. But back then, it was total wilderness. And not only did he attract people from the local town, at that time, Jupiter Island was beginning to become what is now probably one of the highest per capita income communities in the country. And it was sort of an alternate place for people who thought Palm Beach was too glitzy. And the number of old money families who established homes on Jupiter Island was awfully impressive. And they started, as one of them, the Reed family ran Jupiter Island, more or less. They owned the land and they would sell off little pieces for people's homesteads. And at that time, as Nathaniel Reed, who became a very well-known conservationist in Florida, as he would put it, back then, his parents would have guests who would stay a couple of weeks at a time. There wasn't any of this weekend fly-ins. They would arrive by train. They'd have a whole bunch of suitcases, and they would expect to be entertained. And the way that Joseph Reed, Nat's father, would entertain him was put him in the family boat and start the day by going fishing in the wide part, as we call it, of the Loxahatchee River. And then they would, when they caught some fish, they would go up about 6-7 miles upriver to a place called Kitching Creek, where they had built a picnic place all unto themselves, to kind of covered in the woods, but they could easily find a clearing. And there they would cook the fish, have a picnic. And then the highlight of the whole thing was in the early afternoon. They would motor another 3 miles up to Trapper Nelson's. As I say, that was 9 miles up from the ocean. And there Trapper would be in his costume with his snake and all that, and doing his thing. Well, the important part of that little tale I'm telling is that these people were worldwide travelers, most of them from Jupiter Island. And when they went to their little dinner parties in London or Paris or New York, they would recount the most exciting thing that had happened to them in the previous winter. And that was going to see the wild man of the Loxahatchee. It was, in those times, I think it was akin to going into darkest Africa or the wild Amazon. Same thing. And only you had this guy, the real life Tarzan, meeting you and giving you a little lecture. And he's quite articulate, by the way.
You know, him and his brother are riding the boxcars during the Great Depression. What led them to South Florida from, you know, the West and, you know, starting out in New Jersey?
Well, they go home from time to time to Trenton. So let's say, for example, the year before Trapper came down to Miami or to Florida, he was working on a highway project, you know, one of the road gangs. And I guess it was to save money to go out and ride the rails again. And in this case, they'd been out west. And, you know, I don't have any written record from trappers saying why they came to Florida, but I just assume it was the next little frontier for them to go to.
Yeah.
They could have gone all the way to Key West like so many did, but they looked out at Jupiter, which is still today pretty attractive.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how different the Loxahatchee was then from what it is now. I mean, you mentioned about the fish stacked up like cordwood.
Yeah, that would be snook. Mm-hmm. And that's still the prize fish of the Loxahatchee River. You probably don't know this, but I'm also the chairman of the Loxahatchee River District, which is a regional government agency, which is in charge of everything from converting septic tanks to sewers. We have like 300 miles of sewer pipes running underneath the river. I mean, underneath the town of Jupiter and Tequesta. But also we have something called the River Center, where we conduct environmental education. We have a lab which does research on water quality and other things. So I'm just throwing that out as background. So what's unique about the Loxahatchee River? It's 15 miles long. And from today, from the ocean, where you have the total, let's say the inlet is totally a saline environment, saltwater. Then you get into the middle part, let's say mile 3 to 8 is brackish. And then beyond that, for the rest of the 15 miles, it's totally fresh. Well, in the freshwater part, it looks like Tarzan and Jane country. I mean, it's got gorgeous cypresses that brood over the water. There are alligators and all sorts of wildlife. And the reason for that is that it is the first federally designated wild and scenic river by the federal government. At least the first one in Florida, I believe, not the nation. And that happened in 1985. And it happened in part because Trapper Nelson's land was preserved after he died so suddenly and mysteriously.
Fascinating. I liked how you, in the book, you kind of depict both the good and the bad of how pristine it was at the time. That on the one hand, you know, the there were so many mullet that the sound of them jumping actually kept people awake at night sometimes.
Isn't that something? Yes.
That's incredible. But on the other hand, there were so many mosquitoes that people had to sleep with their heads in pillowcases.
That's all true. And the story of mosquitoes is something. I mean, imagine you're a farmer or you're tending your pineapple crop. And the people literally would take newspapers and soak them with kerosene and wrap them around their legs while they were working. And then when they went in at night, a lot of the old houses had a separate entrance room. Like we might call it like a porch, except it was entirely devoted to changing your clothes when you came in at night and throwing them down and then jumping into the house itself to be free of the mosquitoes. I mean, I know Roy Rude, a local luminary who befriended me when I first started doing research on Jupiter history, would tell me that when he owned a landscaping company, and when he was 85 years old, he went to the dermatologist, and the guy said, "You have such beautiful skin. How did you get that?" And he said, "It's probably because when we worked outdoors, we were covered from head to foot. And we wore Frank, you know who Frank Buck was, African explorer. They call him Frank Buck hats, which had a big covering over the neck." But he also said that when in the summertime, when they would sleep at night, they would wake up so sweaty that they had to haul their mattresses out, dry them during the daytime.
Wow.
So all sorts of stories like that. Yeah.
So Trapper Nelson sort of embraced that, though. I mean, living, you know, the way he did.
Yes. A good friend of mine today is Philip Selmer, who was Trapper's grandnephew, who spent several summers with him when he was only, I think, everywhere from age 6 to probably 15. So he knew Trapper among those who were still alive better than anyone. They never really had a problem with mosquitoes that I know of. And it's funny, today, when I live on the river, I'm one of the closest houses to where the wild and scenic part starts at mile marker 6. When we go out on the boat, just to sit around at night, 6, 7 o'clock, have a couple beers, we never see mosquitoes. No CMs are a problem a lot, the gnats sometimes. And if you get a little breeze, then no CMs go away. So I don't know why it's a little less today. My wife would tell you that there are skeeters today. They like seem to like women better than men.
How did he acquire all of this land? You talk about 1,100 acres, yeah. And clearly he's a businessman, so he's making some money. But that's a lot of land to acquire at any time.
Well, you know, when you the long answer is he was known as a very sharp, having a sharp mind from the time he arrived here, even though he had dropped out of school after the eighth grade, when they were first trapping down on the ocean, he would go over to a place called the Du Bois Fish Camp, half a mile away, and help the teachers who, there were school teachers who roomed there, help them grade their papers. Later in the 30s, later 30s, when he was up in his camp, he subscribed to the Wall Street Journal and read it all the time. So you're asking, how did he acquire the land? Well, I'm jumping the story a little bit, but in the heyday of when Trapper really got established in the late 30s, he would host poker games for the local courthouse crowd. Everybody from Martin County, he was right on the edge of the southern edge of Martin County and the northern part of Palm Beach County. So the courthouse gang, the lawyers and the judges would all get together, and Trapper would be the house. He would serve the drinks and he would get the ice and whatever else. He didn't play in the games, but he always made money being the house. It's kind of like the hardware stores who sold the miners their goods. You know, the miners went broke, but the hardware store did fine. So part of his land acquisitions started with these connections. And one of the main ways was in the 30s, if you were delinquent in your taxes, there was a provision where somebody, it was announced by the county, and you could go in and bid on that land, provided you could cover the taxes that hadn't been paid. And then in a couple of years, if you held on to it and paid your regular taxes, the land would be yours. Well, in the First World War afterwards, the federal government had paid bonuses of $500 to people to start farms, well, veterans, that is. And during the Depression, a whole lot of them just went broke. They couldn't keep up their farms. So as these properties fell delinquent, Trapper was eager to pick them up. And they were going for $2 an acre. Today, we've got $5 million homes on the river. Back then, if you can imagine, like dry land would be $4 an acre typically. And if it's in a wetland affected by tides or something, then $2. So he acquired, I mean, I've got documents that show him getting like 40 acres for $100, that kind of thing. Wow. And there were also other situations where people, most of these things I'm talking about were 40 acres plots. Well, there were bigger plots that would become available because richer people couldn't keep up their mortgage payments and so forth. So he would get those. And that's the short story of how he acquired mm-hmm. them. Each one is a different acquisition with its own little drama. Yeah. Yeah. But by the time he died, he had 1,100 acres.
Now, is a lot of that land Jonathan Dickinson State Park today?
It is indeed.
Okay. Yes. And how was that transition made?
Kind of hard to explain to you. If I told you that Jupiter Island has a golf club, and it's one of the wealthiest communities around. Well, modeled after that, some 15 miles south is Lost Tree Village. And the developers of this Lost Tree Village wanted to emulate what they had done as a golf course community by acquiring land up near Cuesta, near the Loxahatchee River. And it so happened that the park, that is by that time Jonathan Dickinson State Park, 11,000-acre park, had come into being. And there was 300-and-some acres that ran along U.S. 1, not far from the ocean, let's just say 200 yards from the ocean. And they wanted to acquire that land, and they had it appraised. And then the heirs of Trapper Nelson also had their inherited land appraised, and they both worked out to be about $1.2 million, I think it was. It was just accidental that it came out that way. But the smaller 360-acre parcel for the golf club was considered more valuable because it was closer to the ocean. You know, Trapper's place had, as we say, mosquitoes and other things like that. So a swap was made, and Lost Tree got this part near the ocean, and the park annexed a part that it is on the south side of the Loxahatchee River. It would be the first time that they own land south of, on the south side of the Loxahatchee River. And that land today is the centerpiece of this 11,000 acre state park. Today you have three tour boats that are at the park headquarters that go up every other hour to visit Trapper Nelson's.
There came a point in his life towards the end of his life where he sort of turned against the public, where he didn't want visitors anymore. What happened?
I think it's a combination of things that is demonstrate the pathos of being a landowner with too much land. By this, I mean, why did Trapper Nelson acquire all this land? And my own theory is, if you have this much land, you want to get more land in order to protect this much land that you had before, because people were trying to poach on the land. That's kind of what he did. It was because it was there and he could get it. So suddenly he's in his 50s. It's 1961. I'm going to try to cite some of these factors. The Florida Turnpike was coming in at only about a mile or so from his place. Eventually, I mean, he knew that plans were being made for I-95 to come down the road. There was now development to the west. His taxes were rising. All of a sudden, he was having to pay what he would consider whopping amounts, like $10,000 a year of taxes. His income from selling animal pelts and things like that, that he declared was never more than $4,500 a year. Now, I grant you, he probably never declared the 25 cents and 50 cents he was getting from people coming into the park. In fact, he actually chucked it into a part of his fireplace, which was later discovered. I think there was something like $3,000 in there when they finally discovered all in coins. He also hid money all around his pineapple patch when people would give him bills. And he literally had done that. So anyway, he was faced by all of a sudden regulations. One day, the Martin County officials came to visit him and said, your animal pens aren't properly, they don't have proper plumbing to flush them out. He said, well, what are you talking about? I have a hose here. I flush them out every day. They said, yeah, but it's going into the river. And he said, well, where do you think it was going while those animals were wild? You know, so it's really got him very irritated. And another factor was that he had family members like Phil Selmer who had come down every summer to help him do one thing and another. Like repair his 100-foot-long dock and things like that. And now they weren't coming anymore. The people his age were now dead, and people like Phil Selmer. Phil was then a kid in college, and he couldn't get down there because he was in the Air Force doing training. There were also gangs of kids who would come and harass him. You know, one of these youthful rites of passage things where they wanted to challenge the Tarzan, the wild man of the Loxahatchee, and his own friends that he had had in Jupiter were dying out. And he also was having prostate problems by this time. People would snicker and say, yeah, well, he ate so many wild animals. This is the result of that and the stomach problems that he had. These were all true. And he thought he had stomach cancer. And all of that led to him closing the camp and becoming, in the eyes of many people, a nasty recluse. If they came to the perimeter of his place and hollered out his name, he would appear with a shotgun from behind a tree and tell him to get out, even if he had been good friends with him for years before. And so this all led up to the day when, one day in July of 1968, or was it 9, Greg? You've read the book more recently than I have. In July, he was found dead with a shotgun at his side by the only person who really had still, he was still in contact with, and that was John Du Bois, who had the fish camp I mentioned before down near the ocean. And the reason why John Du Bois was involved was that Trapper would drive his Jeep down there and use a payphone outside of the fish camp in order to dicker with the state of Florida, which was at that time negotiating to buy his property. So Trapper had a date with an old friend, and the old friend was sitting there at the fish camp wondering why Trapper didn't show up. And so the guy finally had to leave. He was on his way home to Cincinnati, and he and his wife had to leave. So John Du Bois came up with another friend, and as soon as they got to the gate, they smelled something funny. And what it was, of course, was the remains of Trapper, which at this time had been lying there for over a week. He always kept guinea hens in the trees to warn him of people coming. And the guinea hens had partaken themselves of Trapper's brain. Ooh. And a lot of other things. So it wasn't a pretty sight. So immediately, the people in Jupiter, still not a town of more than 500 people, began this fierce debate among themselves. Did somebody kill him? You know, he had made some enemies at this point. Somebody kill him, or did he kill himself? So in the edition of the book that Craig read, I pretty much lean toward the murder theory, because I've had some neighbors telling me fairly convincingly of a certain person who had access to his money and who was not a nice fellow, who was amoral, and who immediately after the death, soon after the death, moved away and bought himself a nice fancy house. Huh. Never could be proven. The man just died recently, and I didn't have any proof, so I never could carry my theory out that far. The other part of the murder theory is that people said that the coroner's investigation was not very thorough. There was, in fact, a fairly long inquest that took place, and some of the local friends of Trapper went to it, and they kind of scoffed at how casual the whole thing was, in their opinion. Now, let's fast forward to November of this year, and arriving in my warehouse very soon is the latest revision and edition of this book. And it has several more photos, more information than the other ones had. And part of the information is that I've since had access to the coroner's report. And it's well over 100 pages. It is very thorough, in my opinion. It was not slipshod. And they examined this thing from every angle that they could, and they concluded that he killed himself. Phil Selmer, his grandnephew, thinks that he killed himself, mainly because all the reasons that I just told you, and his friends were gone, mm-hmm. And that he thought of himself as, he wasn't religious at all, he thought of himself as another animal, and this animal is wounded, and why not put it out of its misery? I'm sort of leaning toward that. But the bigger question still remains, why would a man who was very close to netting $1 million, now that's more like, it's almost 8 or 10 million now, and who talked to his friends of going to see the world and traveling and what he was going to do with his life, why would he suddenly kill himself? And in the book, I speculate that, well, maybe he was just having a particularly painful day, and maybe he was in a irascible mood, and maybe he just picked up a gun and did it.
Talk a little bit about his, there was no formal funeral, but there was a sort of a remembrance for him that I thought was very poignant.
This was just some family friends, two boats, including Phil, some of his sisters and Philip Selmer went up and they recited, which the poem by Robert Louis Stevenson, which is in the book, which I certainly haven't memorized. Maybe you could quote it. You have the book right there.
Yes, I don't have that part marked, but
I don't either. Called Requiem, I guess, by Robert Louis Stevenson.
But they scattered his ashes there, right?
Yes, they did. And just the same way mine is going to be scattered someday. it's unusually pretty river. Neither one of you have been to the Loxahatchee?
I have not.
No, not to spend time there. No, unfortunately.
I really think you ought to do it sometime. There's a lot to do in Jupiter. You know, Jupiter and Equestria are now a town of 100,000 people. But when you're driving down, if you're one of the 9,000 people coming every day, this is something I tell when I give speeches, you won't notice Jupiter that much. And the reason for that is the Loxahatchee River is surrounded by 160,000 acres of wetlands that have been preserved. And it's a patchwork of lands run by the state, the federal government, Palm Beach County, Martin County, Jonathan Dickinson State Park. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the Loxahatchee needs these wetlands to feed the stream, because it's the only river, at least in South Florida, not connected to Lake Okeechobee. That's very important, because the Lake Okeechobee delivers toxins downstream, right and left, literally right and left, but not to the Loxahatchee. And that's what makes it still a relatively pristine river. Oh, it's got, you know, its problems with this chemical and that chemical and this neighbor dropping, putting cut grass in it and things like that. But it still is a wild and scenic river that we work very hard to protect. And
I found the poem. Let me read it real quick.
Sure.
And you're right. It is called Requiem by Robert Louis Stevenson. Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me die. Let me lie. I'm sorry. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the verse you grave for me. Here lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill.
Yes. Now, one and a sober thought here is that I don't think Trapper had picked out any poem for himself before he picked up the shotgun, if he did. So
he left the arrangements for others. Yeah. People can still go visit his landing, right? That's still part of the state park now.
Absolutely. You can kayak down to it from a place called Riverbend Park, which is, in fact, if you're one of the 9,000 people coming every day, you could stop for lunch at McDonald's and go over to Riverbend Park, and you could rent kayaks and go down to Trapper Nelson's. Or you could go to the main entrance of Jonathan Dickinson Park on US 1, and you have to drive about 4 miles in, and then you reach the Loxahatchee, and you reach the concession boat ramp where they have all sorts of boats and kayaks to rent. Plus, they have these three big pontoon boats that each seat 40 to 60 people, and they can, I think it's $10 or so, you take a trip up to Trapper's. Yeah. And you can see it. It's very eerie. You know, it still doesn't resemble the very lively place that was maintained heroically by one man, because although the animal pens are there, there's nothing in them. There's talk about putting them in, but that really creates a problem.
Yeah.
There are the cabins that he had, but they're not furnished. There's just an old bed in there with springs on it. But it's impressive. You know, the orchards that he had, the pineapple patches, there's only a few remains of that. One thing that would give you the best feel for Trapper is that he was famous for chopping a cord of wood a day, and his wood pile extended for, it's, let's just say, 200 feet easy, about 6 feet high.
Wow.
One thing I'd like to slot in, if we still have a moment, is at the time that he was killed, or no, I'm sorry, at the time he died, the park still didn't, it was still a newish park, and it didn't have enough money to have rangers inspect, visit, or improve Trapper's property at all. And so for many, many weeks, it just lay there as if Trapper had gone to the store. Like one teenage gal who drove up with her boyfriend would say how she opened the icebox, and there inside this gas-powered refrigerator was some chicken that he just bought from the stores, and you know, some milk and things like that. Over that time, the place was horribly trashed. the reason, one of the main reasons, was everybody thought Trapper Nelson was rich, and he, because he had sold some land in 1964 for $320,000, they all thought that he had netted $320,000. Well, at that point, he was deep in debt. He probably didn't net more than 60 or 70. But they were convinced that he hid his money all over the property. And so they dug up his pineapple patch. They dug out valuable trees and just made it. They sunk his rowboats that he had for rent. They just made it that all of his 300 traps disappeared somehow. And it was a horrible mess. When they finally were able to get up there and protect it, there wasn't a whole lot left.
How do you think he would like to be remembered today, as Florida's version of Tarzan, or a man who preserved a valuable river and valuable river frontage?
Well, I think all of the above. An interesting character. He'd like to be remembered probably exactly as we're remembering him right now by doing a program about it. Yeah. And I mean, when I first moved here, I'm no native here, by the way. I moved here in 1992. I moved on the river, and I've always been a kayaker. So one of the first things I do is I get my kayak, and I go up three miles or so to Trapper's, and I get out. And at that point, in 1992, there wasn't any information. There was a tree with a glass case, and in the glass case was a one-page thing that some ranger had typed up, you know, giving Trapper's entire life in, I don't know, 500 words. Well, I'm exactly like you, Craig, in that I'm a born journalist and writer. And if I see a story somebody hasn't done, I want to do it before they do it.
Sure.
And so I said, well, this place is the centerpiece of the park, and this is all the information you got? Give me a break. So I started researching. I talked to members of his family. See, his family members from Trenton, once they got their million too, they all quit Trenton. Well, they didn't know. They all went down to Chavanier in the Keys and bought a whole bunch of rental houses. And they lived there in the summertime and rented them otherwise, or the wintertime, also rented them. So I was able to go down to Chavanier and interview them.
Oh, that's great.
They were a little bit suspicious of me, but
they thought you were looking for clues to the treasure.
James D. Snyder has been our guest. The book Life and Death on the Loxahatchee, the story of Trapper Nelson, a fascinating character from Florida history I was completely unaware of, and look forward to learning more about and taking that trip to Jonathan Dickinson State Park and kayaking up the Loxahatchee and getting to know more about Florida's Tarzan.
It's a fascinating story. Thanks very much for writing it, Jim.
Thank you much, Jim.
Thanks so much.
When did you first become aware of Trapper Nelson?
Believe it or not, reading the novels of Tim Dorsey. Grew up in that area and was familiar with the legend of Trapper Nelson, and even kind of worked that camp and the hunt for the treasure into one or two of his novels. So
really,
it made me curious. You know, that's the fun thing about reading Tim Dorsey's works is that he weaves in a lot of Florida lore in amongst all the wackiness and the various crimes being committed by his main characters. And they're actually a pretty good source for learning about Florida. You know, they'll lead you to find out other stuff. And that's what this did.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.